Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You know technology is transforming our world quickly, but it's happening even faster than you think. For example, when a business brings a new server online, how long do you think it takes before that server gets compromised? For example, before it gets infected by, say, a virus? You think it takes a year? A month? A week? Well, Jeff Howe, professor at Northeastern University, has the answer.
When a new corporate server comes online, it will be compromised in 25 minutes.
25 minutes. Yeah, I had the same reaction too.
Like that, just that the network, the internet, is such an enmeshed collection of such a dense weave in ways that we, the human brain, can't even conceive.
In other words, our Homo sapien brains aren't all that different from how they were wired back when we sheltered in caves. But those same brains have created a world that's changing faster than we can understand or cope with. That's why Howe, along with Joy Ito, director of MIT's Media Lab, got together and created what they're calling a new operating system for the world. It's in their new book called Whiplash. They're pro tips, really, for retraining our brains and societies. Things like prioritizing disobedience over compliance, seeing the world as groups of systems rather than objects, and navigating life thinking you've got a compass to get you through uncertainty rather than a map that falsely projects certainty. Well, I spoke with Jeff Howe and Joy Ito about their book and started by asking them what makes the time we're living in now categorically different than other moments in history where technology produced transformational change.
First of all, I think there are more things coming together at the same time. So you've got AI and synthetic biology and the internet and Moore's Law. So first of all, it's hitting all together and they all sort of accelerate and affect each other. So there's a bunch of things that make this a very peculiar time.
I think it's what Joey said. It's not even so much. I mean, I do think that the pace of change is increasing, but it is this confluence that we're not at it yet, but it is soon. And it's gene editing techniques, it's artificial intelligence. And it's just fascinating that technology can move at this really rapid pace, but it takes a long time for humans, especially institutions, I think, to change and to innovate and to see what innovations will stick and what do people want. There's a lot of trial and error that have to take place.
Can you give us a couple examples of technologies right now, you think, that are outpacing our ability as a society to understand them?
So there's CRISPR, which is the ability to edit genes very cheaply. But Kevin Esvelt in my lab is working on CRISPR Gene Drive, which is the ability to use CRISPR to modify an organism like the genes of, say, a mosquito so that it's resistant to Zika. But what CRISPR Gene Drive does is creates a system so that all of the offspring between this modified mosquito and any other mosquito in the wild, all of the offspring inherit this resistance. So you could feasibly deploy a modified mosquito that's resistant to Zika and then within several generations eliminate any mosquito that could carry Zika. And so the question is, who decides? How do you engage the affected communities? And then also, how do you prevent people from doing irresponsible things? Because with CRISPR, it's now high school kids can do it. And it's just the beginning. The things like CRISPR will continue to come out.
Just to give you an idea of the speed, CRISPR was discovered after we started working on the book, was perfected around the time we began composing the book, like really getting into the writing, and had reached high schoolers by the time we were in edits.
And one key thing as a scientist, which is important, is the first deployment of a technology often affects the way the public thinks about it. So if electricity, you know, had not been lighting up Paris, but had been electric chairs, people would have a very different view of electricity at the beginning. Whereas GMOs, you know, the first deployment was really kind of a company trying to sort of prevent people from having freedom. So there's a sort of very negative view of GMOs when, in fact, GMOs can be used to do wonderful things. And so one of the things we want to be very careful about with CRISPR Gene Drive is that the initial deployments are managed by the people who are affected and are done in a really responsible way, because if they are done in an irresponsible way, I think it will really set back our ability to do research.
This is so fascinating because, as you write in the book, the sort of cycle of technology in the past was this ferocious period of development, then some stasis, right? So we as a society were sort of able to catch up. But what you're saying now is that the disruption is constant. The pace of change is so fast that that luxurious time that we had as individuals and society to sort of figure things out, we may not have that anymore.
And I think, I mean, if you think about architects or, say, policymakers as sort of central planners, it used to move slowly enough that you could kind of manage things. The problem is when you get complex and you get fast, it becomes kind of like the Soviet Union. You can't centrally plan something that complex. And so what you need to do, and we call this participant design, which is that instead of top-down design, you have to let every element in the system sort of be responsible for its own design and be kind of bottom-up. So you're not stuck in traffic, you are traffic. So it's not like the central scientist or a company delivering stuff to the public. It should be everybody.
Yeah, so let me ask you, because, I mean, you talk about the internet in quite a bit of detail, and I just want to read a little section here. You say, the internet has played a key role in this, providing a way for the masses to not only make their voices heard, but to engage in the kind of discussion, deliberation, and coordination that just recently were the province of professional politics. Now, I think we're living in a moment right now where we're also wrestling with the potential downside of this aspect of emergent systems. I mean, I'm in the news business, so I'm thinking, like, everyone's talking about the danger of fake news, right? Mm-hmm. And that's also part of different constituents having a voice in the discussion. So how do we manage what are the potential negative aspects of these systems as they come up?
You know, I think there was an unfortunate, like, sort of a techno-utopianism, that there was an embrace of technology as sort of inherently democratizing, and that was an unconditional good. Like, democracy will always be good. If you get more people involved, that's more equitable, it's more fair. And it's like, well, guess what? Sometimes getting more people involved means that, you know, you don't like the product of their decisions, or that it makes it easier to promulgate lie and rumor and calumny. And I think we're seeing the effects of that, and we have to remember that technologies are neutral.
Yeah, and I think if you were to compare the two candidates, I think Donald Trump had this may sound controversial, but I think he reflects the principles in the book much better than Hillary did. He rode the wave of a lot of the stuff that's happening. So, and you know, to be honest, if you look at the Twitter data from our lab, it shows that the mainstream media journalists were not connected to the Trump supporters' conversations on Twitter at all, right? So they weren't talking to each other. And so I think this should be a wake-up call to people who are trying to run top-down political systems, journalists who are just talking to each other. And there's a kind of elitism that's happened. So I'm thinking about science. If you think about the original moonshot, we had kids in Iowa building model rockets, right? This was an optimistic dream that included everyone in America. Now the moonshots are kind of Silicon Valley moonshots or sort of the medical establishment in Washington, D.C. and Boston. And we kind of left a whole bunch of people behind. And so I feel like, again, assuming that democracy is a corrective system and that we do take this moment to sort of be reflective, I think it's a great reflection of exactly the whiplash that we've created, where the sort of elite have, you know, gone ahead of the body. And the body is sort of left behind.
So really, as you write in the book, you're trying to offer us all, you know, a new OS for the world, right? But underlying this, I mean, you confront a fundamental truth about, in your words in the book, our current cognitive tool set leaves us ill-equipped to comprehend the profound implications. Mm-hmm. And that your mission is to provide readers with tools to bring our brains into the modern era. So what is in our current cognitive tool set that makes us ill-equipped to deal with our present and future?
I mean, an addiction to this illusion of certainty. The world has never been a very predictable place, but now there's real cost associated with pretending that it is. You know, and you should have a better shot of it. You had your sales team, you brought them all together, and you spent weeks putting together your sales forecast, and it might have, a decent shot of giving you an idea of what future earnings would be. But, you know, volatility is increasing across the board, whether it's just commercial or planning for your family or an institution planning for its future.
It is impossible to know everything and to be sure. So it's kind of this idea of feeling okay with the fact that the place is out of control, that you sort of go with the flow, that being prepared is much better than having a plan. There was a great John Cleese joke, how do you make God laugh? Tell him your plans. Yeah. You know, so it's kind of an anti-planning approach, but it doesn't mean that you just then don't do anything. You have to spend that energy that you suspend planning and learning and knowing everything in completeness to developing an ability to sort of know what's going on, to be agile. I think a lot of what institutions do these days is they start out on a mission, and then they get so modular and so organized and so scalable that by the time you look at them, whether you're talking about the Humane Society or Twitter, you sort of forget why you're doing what you're doing.
So personally, as I try myself to cope with and navigate all the changes that we're all living through, I veer wildly between like techno-utopianism and techno-dystopianism, honestly. Mm-hmm. But what I appreciated about this book is it does give you a tool set about how to not fall in either extreme and chart a more sensible path forward. But I wanted to ask you, it makes me think that in terms of young people today, we're not teaching them any of the right skills.
Yeah, we are educating kids as if they're going to end up on top of a mountain by themselves with no cell phone and just a number two pencil, right? In fact, you have a phone with Google and messaging. And so what kids intuitively know is they don't have to memorize everything, that they're going to have friends who are experts about something and they'll talk to them if they're experts at something else. And so the notion of being always connected to people, resources, and not having to learn knowledge and skills that you get online, so you can spend the same amount of time in the space and that brain power on something else. Mm-hmm. And so that's very different, because now you're learning to learn and you're learning to search, rather than sort of memorizing and stalking as if you're going to be out on the, in the wilderness by yourself all the time.
You know, to put like a fine point on it, like Horace Mann comes in the 19th century and reforms American education to make it compulsory, so everyone's going, but to make people who could then go out and act like a widget. And this was a philanthropic urge. Like, he wanted people to be able to survive and be employed, but they were going to have to become part of an assembly line to do that. So you get things like periods and punctuality and looking at the clock. Most people coming from agrarian environments, they didn't look at watches or clocks. So you have to inculcate this in. The problem now is if Horace Mann were alive, he'd be like, hey, dummies, drop it. Like, it's the opposite. If people are going to act like machines, our machines got really good. Like, it's the one way they'll never be employed is if they, so they have to become good at stuff that machines can't do. Meanwhile, our educational system, just as Joey said, is teaching them to do things that machines can do. It's crazy. Yeah.
I do think that we're eliminating passion, which is a key driver. We have a group at the Media Lab called Lifelong Kindergarten, because we believe kindergarten is one of the best learning experiences, and we should continue that, which is, we say, the four P's: project, peers, passion, play. So instead of textbooks, which things you learn in textbooks are very hard to apply out of context, learn through projects. Peers, learning from each other. Kids are known to remember things that they hear from friends more than they remember it from teachers. And in fact, when you teach, you remember the best. Passion, pick the project that you want to work on. So if it's World War II history, that's what you do. And then you learn math and you learn geography. And this is, you know, in the world of AI, you want people to have different opinions and different passions. And so you got to allow the kid to have passion. I meet a lot of kids coming into MIT, and they have all the skills. And you ask them, well, what do you want to do? And so
they
I don't know. So helping kids figure out what they want to be passionate about. And it can change over time, but always nurturing passion. The last B, play. It turns out creativity and thinking about things that aren't predictable, it turns out that play is the way that you get people to be creatives. And so as we think about a AI roboticized world, what you want kids to be is passionate, playful, collaborative, and project-oriented. And right now our schools are textbook-oriented. You better not be cheating, and we don't care whether you're passionate, and you sure shouldn't be playing too much.
Well, Joy Ito is director of the MIT Media Lab, and Jeff Howe is assistant professor at Northeastern University and coordinator of Northeastern's Media Innovation Project. They are co-authors of the new book, Whiplash. Thank you so very much, both of you, for coming in and for sharing this toolkit for the future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.